using digital sonar, text and synthetic voice only. He nodded, trying to follow it all. Okay, up you go. Gideon climbed the ladder, grabbed the bars, and lowered himself into the sphere. Someone shut the hatch and dogged it down as he settled into the lone chair and put on the headset. The interior of the sphere was almost completely covered with electronics, screens, panels, buttons, and dials. The forward viewport was directly in front of his face, and there were left and right viewports as well as a downward-looking port. A small console to his right contained a keypad, a joystick, and a few emergency buttons in little cages that could be flipped up. Everything was illuminated dimly in reddish light. A moment later, Alex's voice came in. Gideon, you read?
Loud and clear.
I'm going to go through every console and screen, from left to right. For the next 60 minutes, she proceeded to describe everything in the sphere in excruciating detail, until Gideon despaired of remembering it all. At last she concluded with the joystick panel. This is really all you need to know, she said. The joystick works like any normal joystick, forward, back, port, and starboard. The more you push it in any one direction, the faster the sub will go. But it's always on fine autopilot control, which means it will correct any mistakes you make. If you push the stick forward to enter, say, a hole in the side of a ship, it will automatically steer you through the hole, touching nothing. It will navigate you down tight passageways without touching any walls. It will keep you from grazing the bottom or striking underwater obstacles. The autopilot takes its cues from you, but then handles the details itself. It won't enter a space too small for it, and it won't obey if you direct it into the sea floor or a cliff.
Is there any way to shut it off?
Not directly. That's the whole point. If necessary, control of your DSV can be transferred to the surface, however. Now, do you see those two red buttons under the flip-up cages? The one that says Emergency Eject will jettison your titanium sphere, which will rise fast to the surface. This has never been tested, and the rapid rise might kill you, so don't do it. And the Emergency Beacon activates your beacon if you get into trouble. What's the point of an Emergency Eject if it might be lethal? It's a last resort. Okay, ready for the wet run?
No.
The crane will pick up your DSV, put it in the water, and release it. You'll begin to sink automatically, controlled by the autopilot software. Normally, there would be 200 pounds of iron ballast aboard to rapidly take you the 2 miles down to the wreck. But the water here is only 100 feet deep or so, so that won't be necessary. The autopilot will bring you to a halt 10 feet off the bottom. You wait and do nothing until I tell you what to do.
Yes, Captain.
He felt the sub being hoisted, then swung out over the water. Then he was lowered, ever so gently, until blue water appeared in the viewports. And then, with a clank, the sub was released and began to drift downward. Running lights came on automatically, front, astern, and below. He could see bubbles ascending around him. The water was murky, but in a few minutes the bottom began to take shape. As promised, the sub slowed and came to a hover about 10 feet above a bed of waving kelp in dark green water. There was a soft hiss of warm air. Gideon didn't like the feeling of claustrophobia. He almost could feel the press of water above him, the thickness of it in the air he was breathing. And then, 20 feet in front of him, he saw the other yellow sub drift down and come to a halt, its running lights winking at him. Gideon, do you read?
I read.
Why don't you start by getting a feel for the joystick? Move it forward, sideways, and back, and see how the DSV responds.
How do I go up and down?
Good question. You see the thumb toggle on top of the joystick? Forward moves you up, backward goes down. Go ahead and play with it while I watch and comment. Ever so gingerly, he pushed the joystick forward. A faint humming noise sounded and the sub moved, very slowly. You can be a little more aggressive. The autopilot smooths out any sharp motions you might make. He gave it a bigger push, and the sub moved forward faster. You're coming right at me, Gideon. Try a turn. Instead of turning, Gideon toggled the sub up and it went up and over her sub. Then he toggled back down, and the sub settled just above the layer of kelp. He pushed it sideways, and the sub went into a smooth turn. In a moment, Alex's mini-sub reappeared in the viewport. Gideon, how about learning to walk before you fly? Her instructional tone was beginning to irritate him. He accelerated toward her, then toggled up again, but this time his coordination was off, and the sub went almost vertical, climbing sharply toward the surface. Toggle down. He pushed the toggle down, but accidentally pushed the joystick forward as well. The problem, he began to realize, was that the sub's response wasn't as instantaneous as a car's. Water gave everything a sluggish, delayed effect. And now he was heading straight for the bottom. Fast. Oh, shit. He pulled the toggle and joystick back, but in his panic overcompensated once again and gave it an inadvertent twist. The sub slewed around like a corkscrew before coming to an abrupt halt, unbidden, just above the kelp. A small red light was blinking, and a genteel alarm was sounding. On the main control screen, a message appeared. Full autopilot takeover. Release of control to operator in 15 seconds. He watched as the numbers counted down. Son of a bitch, he muttered. Alex's cool voice sounded in his ear. Well, Gideon, congratulations. That was the most remarkable display of ineptitude I have ever seen in a DSV. Now that you've gotten your teenage yayas out, want to try again? This time, as an adult? If you weren't yammering in my ear all the time, he said angrily, I might have pulled it off, bloody backseat driver. Alex's cool voice came through. Keep in mind that our conversation and everything we do is being closely monitored in mission control. Gideon swallowed his next comment. He could just picture Glynn, Garza, and the rest assembled in the control room, listening and frowning with deep disapproval. Or perhaps laughing. Either way, he felt annoyed. Right. The seconds had now ticked off, and the screen read, Control released to operator. He eased the joystick forward, and the sub moved slowly in a straight line, and then he executed a gentle turn, came back, and halted. There's a good boy, said Alex. Nice and easy. Gideon almost thought he could hear a faint snigger sounding in his headset. Chapter 9. The RV Batavia had crossed the line with all the silliness and concomitant ceremony that passing the equator entailed, which Gideon had retreated from with alacrity. For the past 15 days, since leaving Woods Hole, life on board the Batavia had been dull. Seasickness alternating with bored overeating, reading, watching Game of Thrones in the ship's theater, playing backgammon with Alex, where he was now about 100 games behind, and trying not to drink too many cocktails in the evening. Although by now he had met numerous scientists and many of the ship's other major players, Natalie Dressed ship's chief engineer Frederick Monckton, Eduardo Betances, dour and formidable chief of security, and warrant officer George Lund, who seemed intimidated by everything and everybody. He had made few friends on board. Most of the crew were ex-Navy, with crew cuts and pressed uniforms, not Gideon's type at all. And the various scientific and technical teams were too busy preparing for their upcoming duties to do much socializing. Glynn was as remote as ever. Gideon and Garza, despite the recent thaw in their relations, remained wary of each other. The only one he really liked far too much, was Alex, but she had made it clear that while she, too, enjoyed his company, shipboard romance was out of the question. But there was one character aboard ship who, over time, began to intrigue him. The ship's doctor, Patrick Bramble. He was like a gnome, a devious old fellow with a head as shiny as a cue ball, a small face, sharp, crafty blue eyes, and a stooped way of slinking about the ship, like a ghost. He always had a book tucked under one arm, and never appeared in the mess hall, apparently taking his meals in his room. The rare times Gideon had heard him speak, he'd detected a soft Irish accent. What intrigued Gideon most of all was that, aside from Glynn and Garza, Bramble was the only member of the expedition who had been on the Rolvog when it sank. Gideon had the nagging sense that Glynn and Garza were withholding information about the shipwreck, perhaps even lying about the fate of the Rolvog in order to secure his nuclear expertise. For this reason, Gideon decided to pay Bramble a surprise visit. So one muggy, tropical afternoon, he made his way to the crew quarters and, making sure Bramble was in his room, knocked on the door. At first there was no answer, but he knocked again, loud and persistent, knowing the devious old coot was holed up inside. After the third knock, an irritated voice finally responded.
Yes?
Can I come in? It's Gideon Crewe. A pause.
Is this a medical issue?
The voice filtered through the door.
I'll be glad to meet you in the sick bay.
Gideon didn't want this. He wanted to beard Bramble in his element.
No.
He said no more. The less explanation, the less Bramble would be able to find a reason to say no. A soft rustle, and the door unlocked. Without waiting for an invitation, Gideon pushed in and Bramble, taken by surprise, automatically stepped back. He was holding a Trollope novel in one veined hand, his finger marking where he'd been reading. Gideon took a seat, uninvited. Bramble, his wizened face wrinkling with annoyance, remained standing.
As I said, if it's a medical issue, the clinic is the proper place.
It's not a medical issue. A silence.
Well then, said Bramble, not exactly defeated but resigned. What can I do for you?
Gideon took in the large room. It astonished him. Every single inch of wall space, even the portholes, had been covered with custom-built shelves, and those shelves were completely lined with books, all kinds of books, the most eclectic range imaginable, from leather-bound classics to trashy thrillers to non-fiction books, biographies, histories, as well as titles in French and Latin. As his eye roamed the collection, the only type of book he did not see in evidence was medical.
This is quite the library, said Gideon.
I am a reader, came the dry voice. That is what I do. Medicine is a sideline.
Gideon was impressed by this frank announcement.
I guess being on a ship, you get a lot of time to read.
That is the very point,
said Bramble in his high, whistling accent. Gideon clasped his hands and looked at the doctor, who was eyeing him curiously, no longer irritated, or at least so it seemed. The doctor put down the book.
I see you are a man who has come to me with a purpose.
Gideon already sensed that Bramble would respond well to directness. He knew when a person could not be socially engineered, and the ship's doctor was just that person. Glynn says he's given me the full story on the sinking of the Rolvog, said Gideon flatly. But something tells me he left part of it out.
Well, that would be like him.
So I'm here. To hear the story from you. Bramble gave a small smile, grasped the arms of what was evidently his reading chair, and eased himself down.
It's a long story.
We have all the time in the world.
Indeed.
He made a tent of his fingers and pursed his lips.
Do you know about Palmer Lloyd?
I met him.
Bramble's eyebrows shot up.
Where?
At a private mental institution in California.
Is he insane?
No, but I'm not sure he's sane either. Bramble paused, considering this a moment.
Lloyd was a curious man. When he learned that the world's largest meteorite had been found on a frozen island off Cape Horn, he became determined to have it for the museum he was building, and he hired Glenn to retrieve it. EES bought their ship, the Rolvog, from a Norwegian shipbuilding company. It was a state-of-the-art oil tanker, but they disguised it to look like a shabby old tub.
Why an oil tanker? Why not an ore carrier?
Oil tankers have sophisticated ballast tanks and pumps, which would be necessary to stabilize the ship. Not only was the meteorite the largest ever, but it was incredibly dense, 25,000 tons. So Glynn and Manuel Garza had to develop elaborate engineering plans to dig it up, transport it across the island, load it on the ship, and bring it back and up the Hudson River.
He paused again, reflecting.
When we arrived at the island, it was surely one of the most godforsaken places on Earth. Isla Desolacion. Desolation Island. And that was when things started to go wrong. To begin with, the meteorite was not a normal iron meteorite. Manuel told me it had peculiar qualities. I'd say being an alien seed is peculiar enough.
Bramble smiled mirthlessly.
It was a deep red in color, made of a material so hard and dense that the best diamond drills wouldn't even scratch it. Indeed, it seemed to be composed of a new element with a very high atomic number, perhaps one of the hypothesized elements in the so-called Island of Stability. This, of course, made it far more interesting. It was gotten aboard ship with great difficulty, but successfully.
But as we started for home, we came under fire from a rogue Chilean destroyer.
Glynn, through a typically brilliant stratagem, managed to sink the destroyer. But the Rolvag was badly damaged herself, and a storm came up with a heavy sea. The meteorite started to shift in the hold, the cradle becoming more and more damaged with each roll of the ship.
He glanced at Gideon.
You know about the dead man's switch?
I know that Glynn refused to use it.
That was the damnedest thing. Even when Lloyd himself was begging Glynn to throw that bloody switch, he wouldn't do it. He's one of those men who cannot fail. For all his talk of logic and reason, underneath, Glynn's as obsessive as they come.
Gideon nodded.
I understand the captain went down with the ship.
Yes.
What a tragic loss.
Bramble shook his head.
She was an extraordinary woman, Sally Britton. When Glynn refused to activate the dead man's switch, she ordered an abandoned ship which saved dozens of lives. She insisted on remaining aboard. Then the meteorite broke free, tore a gash in the hull, and there was a huge explosion. Britton died, but Glynn was somehow blown free and survived. A true miracle. He's a cat with nine lives.
Gideon did not go into the story of Glynn's previous crippled condition, or how he had been cured.
And you? How did you survive?
Bramble went on in the same dry, jaunty voice, as if he were describing something that had happened long ago to someone else.
After the explosion, most who survived found themselves in the water, but there was a lot of floating debris and a couple of drifting lifeboats. Some of us were able to get aboard the lifeboats and make our way to an ice island. We spent the night there, rescued the next morning, but a number of people froze to death on the island in the darkness. As a doctor, I tried my best, but I was helpless against the overwhelming cold.
So Glynn really was responsible for all those deaths?
Yes, Glynn, and the meteorite itself, of course.
Bramble glanced around at the walls of books.
It was only later that MacFarlane figured out what the thing really was.
Glynn mentioned MacFarlane to me, but there wasn't anything about him in the briefing files. What was he like?
Bramble gave another of his half-smiles. He spread his hands.
Ah, yes, Sam. He was a good soul, a bit rough around the edges, sarcastic, blunt, but a fellow with a good heart. Brilliant, too, one of the world's experts on meteorites.
I understand he survived.
Survived, yes, but scarred. Bitter, angry, haunted, or so I've heard.
And you? You're not scarred by what happened?
I have my books. I don't live in the actual world. I am imperturbable.
Gideon looked at Bramble. I have to ask, given all you know about Glynn and his limitations, and all the horror you went through, why did you agree to return for this expedition?
Bramble laid a veined hand on the book.
Plain old curiosity.
This is our first encounter with an alien life form. Even if it's just a big mindless plant, I couldn't say no to the chance to be part of that discovery.
And, he patted the book, in the meantime, I can read to my heart's content.
And with that, he smiled, rose, and offered his hand.
Chapter 10. As they approached the ice limit, drifting icebergs began appearing in the Southern Ocean, and Gideon found their deep blue color and sculptural beauty to create one of the most amazing sights he had ever witnessed. He stood at the rail, watching the ship glide between two gorgeous bergs, one with a hole in it, a kind of ice arch through which the morning sun shone brightly. It was November 20th, which Gideon reminded himself was spring, the weather equivalent to April 20th back home. But the air was surprisingly warm and gentle, the ocean utterly calm. It looked nothing like the screaming 60s he had heard about, so named because at 60 degrees of latitude, the earth was fully girdled by ocean. The winds blew incessantly around the globe, raising enormous seas that circled the planet and, with no land to arrest their course, growing ever bigger and bigger. But this was anything but screaming. The ocean was a mirror that reflected the stately forms of the icebergs drifting northward from the glaciers of Antarctica, shed during the spring calving season. In an effort to orient himself, Gideon had spent some time examining the charts in his briefing book. They truly were in the middle of nowhere. The tip of South America was 650 miles northwest, the Antarctic Peninsula 250 miles to the southwest, and the closest land, Elephant Island, 140 miles west. No, that wasn't quite right. The chart in his briefing book did show a speck of rock, a glacier-covered peak thrusting from the sea, less than 100 miles from their position, called Clarence Island. He breathed deeply of the fresh, clean, salty air, and then felt a presence approach from behind.
Calm as a millpond, Alex Lispinard said, leaning on the rail beside him and gazing across the iceberg-dotted sea, the breeze stirring her long brown hair, her profile etched in the golden sun.
Gideon took a deep breath. They told me it would be rough.
There'll be plenty of that, don't worry.
The ship had now slowed to almost a stop, and Gideon could feel the faint vibration of the deck as the engines began to work, first one way, then another.
Feel that? Alex asked.
That's the dynamic positioning system being activated.
We've arrived.
The ship will hold a steady position from now on, right here, no matter what the currents or winds do. You'll feel the azimuthing jet stopping and starting from time to time.
Gideon nodded.
Staring down at the cold, blue-black water, he felt a shiver, thinking of what lay beneath his feet, thinking that he'd be going down there, almost 2 miles. It filled him with dread.
Yeah, said Alex. It's right below us now, I guess.
Not exactly below, said Gideon. We're about half a mile offset, for safety's sake.
He knew this from all the cramming he'd been doing in his briefing book. He had also dined a few times at the captain's table, where Glynn and Garza also frequently sat, and he had picked up a lot of information about the project that way as well. But he still felt uninformed, and it annoyed him.
He checked his watch. Walk you down to the briefing? He asked.
Sure.
He felt her body moving next to his as they descended the companionway to mission control, the electronic nerve center of the ship. They were early, but Glynn was already waiting on the briefing platform, flipping through a sheaf of papers. During the voyage south, the man had continued to heal, almost miraculously, before Gideon's very eyes. Far from the once crippled figure in a wheelchair, now he no longer needed even a cane to support himself. Glynn motioned for Gideon to join him on the platform. Reluctantly disengaging himself from Alex's warm grasp, he stepped up.
What is it? He murmured.
I might need some assistance in this briefing from the EES slacker in chief, Glynn replied.
How do you know about that? Gideon demanded.
But Glynn's only reply was a wintry smile. The seating area in the center of the room began to fill with the more senior members of the ship's crew and scientific personnel. It was an impressive space, oval in shape, crammed with high technology. The walls were covered with giant LCD screens, most of which were now dark. These screens could supposedly display feeds from a host of underwater cameras, deep submersible vehicles, ROVs, satellite downlinks, shipboard radar and sonar, GPS, and chart plotters. There were rows of computer workstations, and large, sweeping consoles festooned with dials, buttons, keypads, and small LCDs, along with so much else that Gideon could hardly keep it straight. Mission Control looked like it came straight out of a science fiction movie. The meeting hour arrived, and a hush fell over the murmuring group. Looking out, Gideon recognized many faces. Captain Tully, as colorless, respectable, and duty-bound as they came, sitting in the front wearing an impeccably pressed uniform. And next to him, Chief Officer Leonard. Gideon had come to like her quite a bit. She reminded him of a Nordic goddess, a giant blonde, but with a down-to-earth personality, someone who, when off duty, appreciated dirty jokes and seemed to have an endless store of them. She had a low, resonant laugh that was truly infectious and a subversive, bad girl attitude. At the same time, she had a distinct Jekyll and Hyde personality, becoming scarily professional when on duty and projecting an almost supernatural level of competence. Directly behind the captain and chief officer sat the ship's chief engineer, Monckton, and the security chief, Eduardo Betances. And then, sitting in the back behind a scattering of scientists and technicians, was Prothero. He had forgotten Prothero's first name because nobody used it, especially Prothero himself. The man slouched in his chair in his usual faded t-shirt and jeans, keds propped up on the chair in front, face partially hidden under an unruly mop of black, curly hair. A tall, pretty Asian woman sat next to him. Prothero's pale, moon-like face and receding chin with a silly tuft of hair seemed to float in the dim light of the instrumentation, his large eyes and lips glistening with excessive moisture. In every way, Gideon found Prothero to be an off-putting dude. Normally, Gideon was attracted to nonconformists, but Prothero had met his friendly overtures with complaints about his berth, the ship's lack of computing power, the lousy speed of the satellite internet connection, and a host of other grievances, almost as if Gideon were the responsible party. Prothero was the expedition's sonar specialist, said to have the largest collection of recorded cetacean communications and songs in existence. He was rumored to be deciphering their language. He never, however, spoke of this to anyone, at least not so far as Gideon knew. Glynn cleared his throat. "Greetings," he said in a cool voice. "Ladies and gentlemen, we have arrived on the target area. Let me welcome all of you to the ice limit." He paused for a smattering of applause. "To be precise, we are at the shifting boundary of floating ice that surrounds the Antarctic continent, at the edge of the Scotia Sea, about 250 miles northeast of the Antarctic Peninsula. The wreck of the Rolvag and the target object both lie in about 3,500 meters of water, more or less, below us, in an area of the seafloor called the Hesperides Deep. Our position is 61 degrees, 32 minutes, 14 seconds south, 59 degrees, 30 minutes, 10 seconds west." Nobody was taking notes. It was all in their briefing books. "As the Antarctic spring progresses, we will begin to see more and more icebergs start to calve in the warming waters. They offer much spectacle and little or no danger. The true danger here is the weather. We are in the screaming 60s, and even though it is spring, we will probably experience high winds and heavy seas from time to time." He walked slowly across the platform, then turned. "Our mission objectives are simple. We will study this alien life form with the single goal of identifying how it is vulnerable, in order to destroy it. He paused, the emphasis on the last phrase hanging in the air. We are not here to satisfy our own curiosity, to benefit science, or to enlarge our knowledge. We're here to kill it.
Another dramatic pause.
Our first objective in the coming days will be to recover the two black boxes from the roll fog, which will contain vital information about the sinking of the ship, as well as video feeds of the meteorite in the hold, and the actions of personnel on the bridge and other spaces in the last minutes of the ship's existence. We will also map and survey the wreck, and the entity itself. Out of the corner of his eye, Gideon saw Prothero shift in his chair, flinging one leg over the other, his face propped up by one hand. The fact is, since arriving, we have already come face to face with a confounding mystery. Glynn turned to one side, and an LCD panel behind him popped into life, displaying a false color image. Here is a sonar image of the wreck of the Rolvog, which we have just scanned in 25-meter resolution. It's rough, but you can see the ship is in two pieces on the sea floor, about 50 yards from each other. Tomorrow, we will undertake an initial survey dive in a DSV. He turned. Now, here is another sonar image of the area, 200 yards to the south. Another image appeared on the LCD panel. This one was odd, blurry, a vague, almost fog-like swirl of colors. This is a sonar image of the life form that we believe has grown from the so-called meteorite seed dropped on the sea floor. A silence.
But there's nothing there, said a technician.
That, said Glynn, is the problem. There's nothing there. Not even the sea floor is visible. The sonar signal is simply vanishing as if into a black hole, and what small return we're getting is stochastic and constantly shifting.
Is something wrong with the sonar system? Said the technician.
Prothero sat up, his abrasive voice loud in the room.
No, there isn't. As I've said repeatedly, I've checked and triple-checked it.
Well, Alex joined in, it seems to me the likeliest explanation is equipment malfunction.
Hey, there's no equipment malfunction, came the querulous reply. It's all working perfectly. I'm tired of being blamed for this.
Any idea, then, what's happening? Alex asked politely. Listening, Gideon's dislike of Prothero went through the roof.
How would I know? Maybe there's a vent spewing clouds of suspended particulate matter, like clay, into the water. Maybe there's a small erupting undersea volcano. I'm sick of these questions.
Gideon spoke up. No need to get your knickers in a twist, Prothero. Alex is asking legitimate questions. Prothero laughed loudly.
Hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo! The White Knight comes to rescue the damsel in distress!
Gideon, feeling the blood rush to his face, was about to respond when Manuel Garza interjected.
No one is blaming anyone. We've got an enigma on our hands, which tomorrow's recon mission will solve. So let's focus on that and keep the discussion civil.
Prothero gave an audible snort and went back into his slouch.
Regarding the recon, Glynn went on, we're going to keep it simple. One DSV will go down to photograph the target object, along with doing a quick photographic and sonar survey of the wreck so we can get a better idea of its position on the seafloor. Extracting those black boxes will be critical.
He paused.
We'll be doing this recon tomorrow. It took us a month to get down here, and there's no point in wasting any time. Alex Lispinard, as DSV chief, will assign the mission. Any questions?
There were none.
That's all. Thank you very much.
As the room was emptying, Glynn laid a restraining hand on Gideon's arm, indicating he should stay. When everyone had left, including Garza, he leaned over.
Give Prothero a wide berth.
Gideon felt a swell of irritation. He had no business attacking Alex like that.
He's a jerk, and I called him out on it.
And you were humiliated. You'll never win a nasty exchange with him. His IQ is 40% higher than yours.
Gideon laughed.
Really? You've got all our IQs memorized?
Of course.
Now, about the recon. As I said, Alex will be assigning the mission, and she'll want to do it herself. Your job is to convince her to let you do it. If necessary, I'll order her to let you.
Me? What the hell do I know about driving those DSVs? This is a bit too important for a honeymoon dive, don't you think?
A baby could drive those DSVs. But here's why I want you. I sense this recon is more dangerous than people realize, precisely because we don't know what's down there. Why can't we see it on sonar?
That's very disturbing.
So you're saying I'm expendable?
I thought my nuclear knowledge was priceless to you.
You're not, and it is. I never thought I'd say this, but you're lucky. You get yourself out of the most amazing scrapes.
Despite my low IQ?
Perhaps because of it, Glynn said dryly.
How reassuring.
Listen to me carefully, Gideon. I want you down there, seeing things firsthand with your own eyes. You said you needed to be convinced this thing is dangerous before you'd lend your expertise. This is your chance.
Besides, the more you know about what we're dealing with, the more you understand, the more useful it will be when the time comes to build and position the bomb that will destroy it.
And with that, he nodded his dismissal. Chapter 11. They told him the descent would take 40 minutes, if all went well. Gideon, strapped into the DSV known as Ringo, fought back a growing sense of unease and claustrophobia as the submersible was lowered into the water. He'd had a right good argument with Alex when he'd asked her to assign the recon to him instead of herself. Nothing had worked. Wheedling, cajoling, demanding, even telling her to fuck off. In the end, though, he hadn't needed to go to Glynn. She'd taken the matter to him herself, and Glynn had endorsed Gideon's request. The whole incident had left her furiously angry, and that pained Gideon, especially since he wasn't exactly thrilled to be the volunteer guinea pig. The surface of the ocean was visible through the forward viewport, rippled by the breeze, but otherwise calm. He could feel the faint swing of the DSV as it entered the water. In a moment, the submersible was under, with glistening bubbles swirling around the viewport. And then he was staring into the infinite, sun-speared depths. He took a deep breath. He tried to take his mind off the fact that he was going down into the blackness beyond, almost 2 miles deep.
Ringo, do you read?
Loud and clear.
Gideon's mission control contact was Garza, who, although he wasn't exactly the warmest human being, was one of the most competent. For that, Gideon was grateful.
We're going to hold you at a depth of 20 feet while we go through the in-sea checklist. You ready?
So far, so good.
While the DSV hung in the water, still on its cables, Garza ran through a checklist, telling Gideon to flick one switch, read a second dial, turn on this pump and turn off that one, while he confirmed that all systems were go. Finally, Garza said,
Ringo, ready to release in 1 minute.
The procedure, Gideon knew from the topside briefing, was to release the DSV into the water, where it would sink straight to the bottom, drawn down by its iron ballast. At the bottom, the weights would be jettisoned, giving the DSV neutral buoyancy. Because acoustic or electromagnetic communications between the DSV and ship at a depth of 2 miles were impossible, for this first dive, Ringo would remain in contact with mission control by a wire cable, which would unspool as the DSV descended. If the cable broke, apparently this was a common occurrence, the autopilot would automatically take over and bring Ringo back to the surface. The cable would carry all of the DSV's operations, video, and sonar data to mission control, so that if anything started to go wrong, they would know it in real time. Release in 10 seconds. Gideon listened as Garza's voice counted down in his headphones. Then he heard a muffled thunk and felt himself begin to sink. He could see small particles in the water drifting upward past the viewports at a steadily increasing rate. The surrounding sea began to darken, from light blue, to a deep indigo. "All systems green," came Garza's neutral, reassuring voice, every 2 minutes. Now the viewports had faded into black. Occasionally something, a bit of particulate matter, would flash through the DSV's running lights, moving upward as the vehicle sank.
"Take a deep breath, Gideon. Your vitals are starting to rise."
He realized he was breathing fast and shallow, and he could feel his heart racing. They were monitoring his vital signs, of course, and he knew this incipient panic would not look good. He made a supreme effort to regulate his breathing, calm himself down, telling himself this was far less dangerous than crossing 7th Avenue at rush hour.
"Better," said Garza.
Gideon checked the clock. Jesus, it had only been 7 minutes. 33 more to go. One screen showed a continuous sonar image of the seafloor below, and he focused on it to distract himself. The image gradually grew clearer. Two brighter images began to resolve themselves, representing the two pieces of the Rolvog on the sea floor. To the west of the wreck, he could see the strange, ever-shifting, pixelated cloud of sonar return that cloaked the place where the meteorite had landed. 20 minutes. He glanced around, refamiliarizing himself with the controls, then checked the depth gauge, continuously reeling off his depth. 2,000 meters, 2,010, 2,020. The sonar image of the wreck continued to sharpen, but the sonar cloud to its west was, if anything, getting bigger and blurrier. 30 minutes. He was almost there.
"Slowing descent to 50 meters per minute, said Garza.
Gideon felt the change. Or perhaps it was his imagination? Now he could see the Rolvog in detail on the sonar screen. It lay on the seafloor, torn in half, with a debris field scattered around it. Both pieces of the ship, each one impossibly huge, were lying on their sides, at an angle of perhaps 120 degrees. Other than that, the seafloor extended flat in all directions, except for an area about 100 meters in diameter at the spot where the meteorite was estimated to have landed, which was still just a blurry, shifting cloud of pixels. Random sonar return. The wreck grew until it filled the sonar screen, and still kept growing. He could see the DSV was aiming for a spot on the seafloor, perhaps 50 meters from the ship's stern.
"Slowing descent to 20 meters per minute, said Garza. "Gideon, Ringo's light should have a reach of about 100 meters. You'll be able to see the Rolvog invisible light through the downward viewport at any moment now."
"Roger." Gideon kept his eye fixed on the viewport.
"The autopilot will bring you to rest on the sea floor," said Garza. "Then the DSV will automatically blow the ballast tanks to achieve neutral buoyancy, and the autopilot will bring you up 10 meters. Hopefully the action won't throw up too much silt, but if it does, you're down current from the ship and you will remain stationary until the silt clears away."
"Understood." So far Gideon had done nothing but monitor the screens. Gazing through the viewport, he could now see the details of the bottom approaching, faint in the DSV's lights. It was smooth mud with a few scattered depressions and some unrecognizable pieces of debris. The wreck itself was still out of view. The DSV settled down ever so slowly, the bottom coming up to meet him. The muck of the bottom obscured the view out the lower port, and he shifted his gaze to the left and right viewports. To his right, with a start, he realized he could see the dim form of the Rolvog stern, with two gigantic, mangled screws affixed to what looked like pods. The crumpled hull, split along riveted seams, extended on into the blackness.
Ready to blow tanks, came Garza's voice through the communications wire.
Roger.
Now he felt a series of jolts, and a cloud of silt rose up to obscure his view. The DSV ascended briefly, then became stationary again. The viewports remained completely obscured by silt, which was reflecting the headlights back into the DSV, making it bright inside.
We're waiting for the silt to drift down current, said Garza.
Within 2 minutes, the silt had cleared away. He was, as Garza promised, about 30 feet off the bottom. Now he could see the Rolvog in more detail, still faint and at the edge of the spotlight's penetration. Strangely, there was no sign of any deep-sea life, no fish or sea creatures around, and nothing on the ocean floor save scattered bits and pieces of debris.
Ringo, the DSV is yours. Begin recon. Roger that.
Gideon's briefing had been very specific. To pass over the length of the wreck at a height of 20 meters, from stern to bow, then make a second, sideways pass. The DSV was pre-programmed to do a complete photographic, sonar, and magnetic survey. All he had to do was pilot it, making sure to steer clear of any snags. Not that it mattered, since Ringo's autopilot would avoid them anyway. Then, in phase two of the recon, he was to make his way toward the site of the meteorite and see what the sonar cloud was all about, whether it was a cloud of silt, seafloor venting, or something else. Gingerly moving the joystick, Gideon turned the DSV to face the ship's stern, then pushed it forward. With a smooth motion, the DSV hummed along at a slow pace. He maneuvered the mini-sub to a higher altitude above the sea floor. Gradually, the stern came into sharper view, each of its two giant screws larger than his entire vessel. He increased altitude, the DSV responding with the brief delay he was now used to. He made continuous adjustments to keep the path steady and even.
Proceed to the predetermined waypoint, said Garza.
A chart plotter on the main screen showed the waypoint in X, Y, and Z axes, and it took only the merest nudging for the submersible to reach it, at which point he came to a halt.
Commence survey.
Again, the DSV needed almost no help from Gideon, who only had to push the joystick slightly for the craft to follow the predetermined survey line, smoothly and expertly. The whole thing was pre-programmed, and Gideon began to feel that his presence was more or less optional. As he cruised about 50 feet above the wreck, Gideon became even more impressed by its enormous size. They had told him it was bigger than the Empire State Building, and now he was experiencing just how true that was. It went on and on, the warped hull sliding past. He passed the superstructure, then the bridge lying on its side, crushed and scattered about the seafloor in great, wrinkled heaps, with all kinds of cables draped about. One bridge wing stuck up from the hull, its windows shattered. Odd, thought Gideon, that there were no signs of life around the wreck, no fish moving in and out, no plant growth. The entire place seemed dead. But that would be explained, perhaps, by the great depth and lack of light. He reached the spot where the hull had split. The great riveted plates of the ship ripped apart, the peddled pieces of metal warped outward. Clearly, an explosion inside the hold had torn the ship in half, and in the space between the two halves of the ship lay a huge, rotten pile of debris, a gigantic tangle of split timbers and metal struts, which he assumed must be the remains of the cradle for the meteorite. Suddenly, he had a jolt. He could see, lying on the seafloor just outside one section of the hull, an oblong shape that, as he peered more closely, was all too obviously a human corpse. It was missing its head and both of its arms. And as he continued scanning the slowly passing view, he saw another folded shape nearby that, too, was a body. This one was not only headless and armless, but missing one leg as well. Apparently, the limbs had been torn away, by the force of the explosion that sank the Rolvag.
Jesus.
I see human remains down here, he said. Garza's calm voice came back.
We see them too. This is not unexpected. Carry on.
Roger. He swallowed. Why hadn't he thought of that before? And why hadn't they mentioned this in the briefing? Other than the violence done to them by the explosion, both corpses seemed remarkably well preserved, which, he figured, must be due to the great depth. Now he could see the blunt bow approaching.
Nearing waypoint 2, said Garza.
As he passed the bow, the water suddenly became dark again, the sea floor almost too far away for the headlights to reach.
Reaching waypoint 2.
Once again the DSV came to a smooth hover.
We're going to make a second pass, Garza said, to the north and offset from the ship along its deckside. Proceed to waypoint 3.
For this scan, the DSV would be close to the sea floor, scanning the wreck sideways. Gideon maneuvered to the waypoint and began the scan. This was more dramatic, driving only 30 feet above the sea floor, looking at the wreck sideways. Because the two pieces of the ship were lying on their sides, Gideon was now looking down on the decks, which had been slightly accordioned by the impact with the sea floor.
What's that? Gideon suddenly asked.
He could now barely make out a thin, thread-like line, lying on the seabed and twisting off into the darkness.
We see it, said Garza. All right, slow down. Divert from the pre-programmed path and get closer to it.
Gideon eased the DSV over until it was positioned about 10 feet above the thing. He peered at it through the viewport.
Is it a wire from the ship? He asked.
No, said Garza. It's too long. Get a little closer, please. Gideon worked the joystick with the DSV lowered to within 5 feet of the cable. It was smooth, featureless, and pencil thin, and the same gray color as the sea floor it was lying on. Now that he was closer to the bottom, he could see other similar cables lying on the sea floor, some partially buried, some appearing and disappearing in the muck, all snaking off in one vague direction into darkness.
Did you notice they're all heading in the direction of the meteorite? Said Gideon. I'd like to follow these.
A brief silence.
We don't advise that, said Garza.
Finish up the survey. We can examine it later.
My survey of the Rolvag is complete. Since I have to go that way anyway, I'd really like to follow these.
More silence. No doubt they were conferring topside, out of his hearing.
Very well, said Garza. Go slow and do not, I repeat, do not enter any cloud of silt, if there is one, or approach any venting structures. Stay well away from anything that looks unusual or unnatural.
Roger. Gideon turned Ringo and began following the narrow snake-like cables lying on the sea floor. For some reason, they gave him the creeps. And then, through the forward viewport, Gideon could see a large, indistinct, looming form start to take shape. Do you see that?
Yes, said Garza in a clipped tone. And we're losing you in the sonar cloud.
But the water is totally clear.
We see what you see.
Gideon instinctually slowed the DSV to a crawl. His sonar screen dissolved into a wash of noise. However, the submersible's headlights now picked up the form ahead, outlining it with clarity.
Oh my God, he murmured.
Looming ahead out of the darkness was a gigantic, tree-like thing. A grotesque, ribbed growth rising from the seabed, with a fissured, bark-like surface. It towered so far above him that the top of it disappeared into blackness, out of the range of his lights. It went on and on and on.
Go no farther, said Garza, but Gideon had already stopped the DSV.
There was silence topside. Gideon stared. The loose bundles of cable he'd followed ran along the seabed until they reached the vast growth,
combining together and running into its base like a root. Gideon could see a vast number of other similar appendages converging in from other directions as well, going into the base of the structure.
"Holy shit," Gideon said.
Garza spoke again, his voice uncharacteristically tense.
"Time to return to the surface."
"I'm going closer."
Gideon eased the joystick forward.
"No, you're not."
A message popped up on the DSV control screen. Control transferred to surface. The craft stopped responding to the joystick. He heard a clang as the iron ballast was released and the sub began to rise.
"Hey!"
"Sorry," said Garza. "We're bringing you up."
But now, Gideon was rendered speechless as the submersible rose and the enormous size of the thing became fully revealed. He was rising at an angle, away from the tree, and just when its central trunk started to divide into what appeared to be clusters of branches, the thing disappeared into the murk, out of range of his lights.
39 minutes to surface, came Garza's tight voice.
As blackness reasserted itself around the viewports of the DSV, Gideon could only imagine the consternation now taking place in mission control. Chapter 12 Glynn called a meeting for 1 o'clock, barely giving Gideon enough time to change out of his sweaty clothes and shower. When he arrived in mission control, it was already packed. It seemed that everyone who was anyone on board ship was there. Every chair was taken, and in the back it was standing room only. Garza was seated on stage with Glynn. As Gideon entered, Glynn beckoned to him, and he joined them. To his surprise, a scattering of applause greeted his arrival on stage, which became general. He quickly sat down, embarrassed. Wasting no time, Glynn gestured for a wireless mic and spoke into it.
"This debriefing is called to order."
At the sound of his cool, neutral voice, an instant silence fell.
"Most of you have already heard about this morning's recon dive by Dr. Crew. I'm sure I speak for everyone in saying that he is to be congratulated for a successful mission."
Another round of applause. Gideon noticed Lispinard, sitting in the front row. He expected to see anger and disapproval on her face. Instead, he saw an expression he didn't quite understand.
"The purpose of this meeting," Glynn went on, "is to briefly review footage and data from that recon, and then open the floor to ideas, analysis, and discussion. Finally, we will address the next steps to be taken."
He gestured to the tech in the AV booth, and the main screen came to life. The assembled company watched in silence as an edited version of Gideon's reconnaissance played on the screen, with the communications dialogue included. At the end of the reel came a series of magnified stills of the huge thing he discovered, and the tendrils that snaked away from it.
"And now," said Glynn as the footage ended,
"I'll share with you a few additional images. The first are sonar readings of the organism, collected on the recon." This was followed by a series of images similar to the cloud observed previously, ever-shifting pixels of sonar noise. "And here are some sonar readings from the creature. It generates sonar. In other words, it makes a low, continuous noise, in the 2 hertz range, far below that of human hearing. Here is a computer-generated image of its sonar fields." The images showed an eerie, glowing, blurred outline of the thing, with streamers coming off it. He continued with some additional images in various modes, and then paused, looking around the room.
"Very well. I'm going to open the floor to anyone who has anything to say, or any questions to ask. This free-flowing discussion will last 30 minutes, so be succinct."
A bunch of hands went up. Glynn pointed to the back.
"Prothero?"
Why, Gideon thought, call on him first? He was likely to hijack the discussion. Prothero rose.
"Okay,
It's pretty obvious to me what's going on with the sonar.
He looked around.
Nothing wrong with the equipment, by the way. That baobab's got a surface that looks like bark. You saw that? So I took a close look at it under magnification, and right away I noticed that it has a remarkable mathematical quality. It scatters sonar almost perfectly. In other words, the baobab's invisible to sonar. And I can also tell you why.
He paused, looking around again, aggressively, as if waiting for someone to challenge him.
Please do explain, said Glynn, encouragingly.
The baobab grows in deep salt water, in the complete absence of light. That's evidently its natural environment. Sonar is about the only way to see in that environment, and so, to avoid predators, it evolved to be invisible to sonar. Obviously, its home planet was a deep, watery world, perhaps an ocean covered in miles of ice, like Europa or Callisto. That also explains the 2 hertz sound it produces. It's pinging its surroundings, so to speak.
He sat down abruptly. Gideon found himself startled, indeed astonished, at the clear logic of the analysis. Prothero's observations were greeted with a burst of murmuring that filled the room.
Thank you, said Glynn after a moment.
As the room died again into silence, Alex Lispinard raised her hand.
Alex?
2 things struck me. First, the complete absence of sea life in the vicinity. In the benthic zone, you don't typically see a lot of life, but this area is dead.
What sea life would you normally expect to find? Asked Glynn.
A few scavengers, hagfish, crabs, and such, which feed on carcasses that sink from the upper regions. You'd also see detritivores, which feed on decomposing animals and plants, and also gobble up feces sinking from above. And epifauna and infauna would live on and in the seafloor itself, but I saw no evidence of any of these at the site.
Any speculation why not?
On land, there's a phenomenon called allelopathy. Some trees and plants reduce competition around themselves by releasing chemicals into the soil that harm other plants or stop the germination of seeds. We may be seeing that here.
And the other thing that struck you?
The human corpses. Beyond what I assume to be damage caused by the initial explosion, they show almost no signs of decomposition that I could see.
Any theory as to why? Glynn asked.
At that depth and pressure, organic remains begin to dissolve even if they're not attacked by microorganisms. I have no idea why they're so well preserved.
This generated a long discussion. Glynn managed it, giving everyone a chance to speculate and ask questions. When the half hour was over, he gently closed the conversation.
I'd like to conclude by pointing out something that has undoubtedly occurred to many of you already.
He stood and began to pace the stage slowly.
Dr. Prothero, it seems, has put a name to this organism, the baobab, and I endorse it. The baobab is currently quiescent. It went silent, so to speak, after an initial burst of activity and hyperactive growth following its sprouting. I privately hoped we might have found it dead, but these images suggest it is very much alive and healthy. It seems certain that at some point it will fruit and produce seeds. We already know what these seeds look like, because the so-called meteorite was one of them, and we planted it. The seed weighed 25,000 tons, was virtually indestructible, and was composed of a material many times denser than any known element on Earth. Obviously, it evolved for the rigors of interstellar travel. It is a seed designed for panspermia, but not the normal panspermia of spores envisioned by exobiologists, drifting in space or hidden in meteorites. This is panspermia with a vengeance. Terminator panspermia.
There was a nervous titter from the audience.
Which brings me to my point. Once the baobab produces seeds, how will they be dispersed into outer space?
He let that hang in the air.
Think about it a moment. Each seed weighs 25,000 tons.
There seems to be no way for them to escape the gravitational field of any planet they land on. And yet they do escape. So I ask again, what is the dispersal mechanism for these seeds? Another silence. I suggest that there can be only one mode of dispersal, only one way for these incredibly heavy seeds to be released back into outer space and go adrift, to find fertile new oceans in which to sprout and grow. No doubt you can guess what that mode is as well. He took another turn, almost like a television evangelist, and faced the audience again. Once you understand that, you understand what it means for the fate of the Earth, and why we cannot fail. After the meeting had adjourned, and as Gideon was getting ready to go, Alex Lispinard approached him. Gideon? He turned. Look, I want to apologize for arguing with you earlier, escalating the discussion, taking it to Glynn. Forget it, he said. It was my fault. You're the DSV chief. I just felt... She touched his arm. No need to explain. I understand now. What you did, going down there alone, on your second dive, no less, took real guts. And you kept your cool amid a nasty shock. Well, as you said, anyone can drive a DSV, and Garza yanked me up before I did anything stupid. When I was in mission control and that gigantic thing appeared on the screen, I was really taken aback. For a moment, I was damn glad it was you down there, and not me. It's just a tree. She shook her head. I wouldn't make any assumptions about what it is. None at all. Chapter 13 Gideon had never seen so many stars in his life. After dinner, he'd retired to his cabin to unwind in solitude. But the events of the day, the unsettling descent, an even more traumatic ascent in the DSV, and the revelations and speculations of the briefing session that followed, had affected him deeply. He couldn't seem to shake the feeling of the cramped submersible, or the sight of the monolithic, cliff-like flank of the baobab as he ascended beside it. Even his big stateroom felt claustrophobic, and so he'd come up on deck. He wanted to feel the infinite space of the heavens above him as he brooded. Standing at the railing, a gentle spring breeze ruffling his hair, he stared southward. The lights from the ship provided just enough illumination to outline the nearest icebergs, which towered out of the black water like ruined castles, broken spires reaching toward the sky. The sea was a black sheet, reflecting the stars and the bergs, creating a surreal mirror of the dark world above. Hello there. He turned. You like to sneak up on me. It's almost as much fun as tying your shoelaces together. Alex joined him at the rail, leaning her elbows on it, gazing out. This is what I love most, she said, being right here, out in the great